Today is Thursday, September 6th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the New York Times publishes a damning article from an anonymous Trump administration official.
This is a very senior official who's saying the guy I'm working for is not fit to be president.
The march toward a major offensive in Syria seems to move closer.
There's been a relentless countdown to war and a buildup of forces and fortifications.
Also ahead, Africa's elephants continue to be murdered for their ivory. We'll talk to a group working to save them. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, the White House is reacting with anger to a New York Times opinion piece published by a person it said is a senior Trump administration official, asserting that the president's worst impulses are frequently foiled by his own staff. Trump asked about the article following an afternoon event in the East Room, called it gutless, and launched into an extended criticism of the newspaper.
So if the failing New York Times has an anonymous editorial, can you believe it? Anonymous. Meaning gutless, a gutless editorial. We're doing a great job.
The author writes that it could maybe a cold comfort in this chaotic era, but wants Americans to know that there are adults in the room. Joining us now to discuss is George Mason University Professor of Governmental Affairs, Robert Deitz. So have you, in your career, ever seen anything like this?
Never. It's a really unusual thing, and I'm actually a little surprised the Times would do it. A former colleague and I once prepared an op-ed piece. He was in private practice at the time. I was working at the Defense Department, and I could not have my name on it. And so we submitted it as with his name and then anonymous. And the Washington Post rejected it. They said they have a policy of never publishing anonymous op-eds. And that's what particularly surprised me about this op-ed.
Well, of course, they did put a note at the beginning saying that it's a rare step for them to publish an anonymous op-ed essay, but that they just felt that publishing this was the only way to deliver an important perspective. If, in fact, this is a senior Trump administration official making these statements, some of these comments are pretty concerning in regard to the president's ability to do his job.
Absolutely. Yes, they're concerning, but no more concerning than the comments that Woodward was able to elicit about named people.
I guess that's true. It is pretty similar to what the book just said, but yes, why is it a big deal to have this actual first person, like written in first person, I am a part of resistance inside the administration? Given that this is apparently someone very close to the president, a senior official, speaking in first person, telling the American people we want you to know that we know what's going on and that we are doing our best to
undermine the president.
Basically.
Undermine the president's instincts, yes.
What's going on here?
Well, look, it's startling. Although what's interesting about this administration is every time you think you cannot be more startled, something happens that makes you even more startled. And today, you know, is yet another example of that.
Right.
Effectively, what this article said was that this man is not fit to be president. And according to the Times, this is a very senior official, whether it's in the cabinet or in the White House. In any event, this is a very senior official who's saying the guy I'm working for is not fit to be president. That is, I think, astonishing.
Right. When you see sentences like impulsiveness results in half-baked, ill-informed, and occasionally reckless decisions that have to be walked back, this is uncharted territory. And we know that this person, whoever it is that wrote this, also said that in the early days of this administration, many of these people in the cabinet had considered the 25th Amendment, which people may not know what that is. So basically, tell us what that is and...
The 25th Amendment was created to address the concern of a president who was not dead, but who was incapacitated. You know, for example, a stroke victim who's no longer able to think clearly or articulate clearly. And so the question was, what do we do with somebody like that? And the 25th Amendment was designed to address that issue.
My understanding is it also could be if a president was incapable of fulfilling their duties in other ways, maybe in their not physical but mental capacity?
Oh, sure. No, that all counts. Absolutely. It's incapacitated for any reason. The fact that this is even being addressed is startling.
If this person feels this way, and others in the administration, according to this piece, this writing, feel this way and feel this strongly that this person is a danger to our country, Why aren't they all banding together and speaking out?
To me, the major answer to that question is, if these people leave the administration, who will replace them? Who would be better than they are in this position? You know, I don't know who wrote this, but I think he and or she and others may say to themselves, look, if I'm not here, who's going to do this? And so I think that, you know, that's a kind of a higher form of patriotism as well.
George Mason University Professor of Governmental Affairs, Robert Deitz. Meanwhile, American voters will be heading to the polls in 2 months to elect a new Congress and render a midterm judgment on how often controversial presidency of Donald Trump, how the often on that presidency, control of both the Senate and House of Representatives is at stake. But the midterm election results could also have a profound impact on the Trump agenda and the next 2 years of his presidency. VOA national correspondent Jim Malone has a preview from Washington.
Please welcome the President of the United States, Donald J. Trump.
With the future of his presidency on the line in November, President Donald Trump has become an increasingly combative force on the campaign trail.
We need Republicans in Congress. Today's Democrat Party is held hostage by left-wing haters, angry mobs, deep state radicals, establishment cronies, and their fake news allies.
Trump is counting on supporters like coal miner Kevin Abbott in November.
I believe the way Trump believes. I believe he'll, if the people quit roadblocking him, I think he can do amazing things. He's already done so much.
This man has got to go.
But Trump's tenure has also fired up Democrats. They are determined to take back the House in November to stop the president's agenda, including his call for more tax cuts and a border wall. Among those rallying Trump's opposition is Senator Bernie Sanders.
People are standing up. They are fighting back. And they are going together to transform this country politically and economically.
Democrats should have history on their side, says George Washington University expert Lara Brown.
When you look at the overall landscape, what you do see is a very typical midterm election shaping up. And that is that, historically speaking, the president's party doesn't do well. The country does, to a certain extent, see the midterm elections as a check on the president's power.
The yeas are 81, the nays are 18.
A Democratic takeover of one or both chambers of Congress in November would spell trouble for Trump, says analyst Bill Galston.
Number one, no more Republican-only legislation. And number two, House Democrats would then command the mechanisms of oversight, which is, after all, one of the principal responsibilities of Congress.
Trump allies also see the midterms as a referendum on the president, including former advisor Steve Bannon.
This is an up or down vote. It couldn't be clearer. If we keep the House, President Trump's program will continue on. If we lose the House, Nancy Pelosi will try to grind his program to a halt.
We're going to keep on fighting. We're going to keep on winning.
Trump is the central issue for both parties in the midterm campaign, says Gallup pollster Frank Newport.
I think Republicans will actually bring him up. Some of them will say, vote for me, because there's going to be a move to impeach Trump if we have more Democrats in the Congress. And Democrats clearly will say, you need to vote for us because we'll oppose some of Trump's policies. So I think he clearly is a central figure in this election.
Democrats hope to gain enough seats to reclaim a majority in the House, while Republicans are favored to hold their narrow edge in the Senate. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. After fresh cyber attacks, experts say Silicon Valley is showing improved response. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is in India after talks in Pakistan on resetting troubled ties. Bitcoin builds a new Rwanda school. And Facebook and Twitter executives testify on Capitol Hill, but Google was absent. find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is in India after holding meetings Wednesday with leaders of Pakistan's newly elected government, where the two sides agreed to make efforts to reset troubled bilateral relations to jointly push peace in Afghanistan. When addressing the press, Pompeo sounded cautiously optimistic about the outcome of the meetings.
We talked about their new government, the opportunity to reset the relationship between our two countries across a broad spectrum, economic, business, and commercial. The work that we all know that we need to do to try and develop a peaceful resolution in Afghanistan, which benefits certainly Afghanistan, but also the United States and Pakistan.
The relationship between Washington and Islamabad officially allies with fighting terrorism has, and officially allies, I should say, in fighting terrorism has plunged to its lowest point in the past year over allegations Pakistan has covertly enabled the Taliban insurgency to sustain the conflict in the neighboring country. Meanwhile, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, in remarks published Wednesday, warned a Russian-backed pro-government assault on the rebel-held province in Syria could result in a massacre. Turkey will attend a summit Friday in Tehran involving Iran and Russia and an impending assault on Idlib, which is expected to dominate the talks. UN Syria envoy Stefan de Mistura called on the Turkish and Russian leaders to hold urgent talks on ways to avert an assault that he believes could begin in earnest on or around September 10th. Mr. de Mistura's special advisor, Jan Egeland, a Norwegian diplomat and Secretary General of the Oslo-based Norwegian Refugee Council, spoke with International Edition's Victor Beatty about it.
We're very, very worried that this is just before the hurricane. There's been a quiet now before this storm. Yesterday there was air raids again. There has been a relentless countdown to war and a buildup of forces and fortifications. And everybody seems to forget that there are 2.9 million civilians in Idlib, and they would come in the crossfire.
The UN Security Council expected to take the matter up on Friday. What do you hope they'll talk about?
I hope that the Security Council will focus on the civilians, on the 1 million children that are there in Idlib. I hope the Security Council, and I really hope that the three most influential countries that are Russia, Turkey, and Iran, and who are meeting in Tehran on Friday, will agree that in this war on terror, as they label it, the victims of terror are as important to protect as killing terrorists. Because the experience so far has been that when one goes after terrorists, like one did in eastern Aleppo, in eastern Ghouta, and in Raqqa, it ended up in intolerable costs to the civilian population.
Mr. de Mistura said the key to averting a bloodbath is for Mr. Putin of Russia and Mr. Erdogan of Turkey to meet. What would they hope to discuss?
What we hope is that they will discuss talks that would lead to the laying down of arms, the agreement on the future of these areas, and not only with the armed groups that are not listed as terrorists, we also need some way of reaching out to the other groups, because they control big parts of the territory and a lot of civilians live under their rule. It has been possible to make agreements in many areas of Syria before that did shield the civilian population. In other areas, everything was smashed, and it's no way to liberate an area or to liberate a people by killing everybody there.
The United States, again, threatened to respond swiftly if chemical weapons are used. How concerned are you about that?
I'm concerned about the use of chemical weapons. It has been repeatedly used in Syria with great suffering of the civilian population. But perhaps 1% of the civilians killed have been killed by chemical weapons. So let's also remember the 99% of others who are also killed unlawfully, civilians should be protected and shielded by international law. There are 100,000 babies in Idlib, so many more babies than fighters in Idlib. Of course, we also appeal to the armed opposition groups as well, many of them increasingly reckless and increasingly ruthless against the civilian population that they portray fighting for. They should understand also the cost for the civilians if there is now a battle street by street, village by village, for weeks perhaps or more in Idlib.
That's Jan Egeland, a Norwegian diplomat and secretary general of the Oslo-based Norwegian Refugee Council. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.
Hi, this is Victor Beatty, managing editor of VOA News. Tune in to the Voice of America's newscasts every hour on the top of each hour, 24/7. Listen to our news and correspondent reports from around the world. VOA is your trusted source for news and information.
VOA's International Edition continues. Well, Botswana, long viewed as a rare refuge for African elephants, is coming under increasing threat from poachers after wiping out large numbers of elephants in nearby Zambia and Angola. Wildlife officials in Botswana say a recent elephant census counted nearly 90 fresh and recent carcasses of poached elephants. A similar census in 2014 found just 9. President Mogwetsi Masisi, who took office in Botswana this year, has taken steps to reduce the use of military weapons and operations against poachers, according to local media reports. While the move may have alleviated tension with Botswana's neighbors, conservationists believe it could be providing an opening to emboldened ivory traffickers. Joining us now is Frank Pope. He is the CEO of the group Save the Elephants, joining us from Kenya. First of all, what is your response to this latest report of these deaths?
Well, I think the first thing to note here is that although the discovery of these 87 elephants during an aerial survey of an area of Botswana is shocking, they weren't all from one incident killed at one time in one place. This is there have been other massacres that have happened of elephants, shocking massacres that have happened in this ivory crisis, but this doesn't seem to be one of them. This is really the latest instance of poaching that's been increasing in Botswana for the last decade or more. And we've seen this, the rates of discovery of carcasses starting to creep up in the survey reports coming out of Botswana for a decade. We've been warning Botswana and southern African nations like South Africa and Mozambique that poaching rates would increase as all the easy-to-kill elephants in Central Africa and East Africa start to get depleted. And sure enough, we're seeing it more and more now. And it's as simple as why do robbers rob banks? Because where the money is. Botswana has more elephants than anyone else left, and so they're next to be targeted. And Botswana has historically done a really good job of looking after their elephants. And I think that perhaps they've got a little complacent and they thought things had been working, but in fact the rot of poaching has set in, and this latest discovery is evidence of that.
So the numbers of elephants in surrounding countries in Africa are being depleted from poaching, and so this is the place where there are now the most, and that won't continue if this keeps up, I imagine.
Yeah, as long as the demand for ivory remains, principally in the Far East at the moment. And, you know, it's shifted from being in Europe and America in the 70s and 80s and Japan. It's moved now to principally China. The Chinese government has taken this very seriously and has turned around in an amazingly short time to go from thinking that ivory was a piece of intangible cultural heritage just 2 or 3 years ago to saying, okay, we accept there's a problem and we're going to ban it. But banning something that's desirable is only half the battle. You still have to persuade people that it's not desirable. The price has fallen by 2/3 since 2014, but that has somewhat plateaued recently to around $700-$800 a kilo in China, the black market price, and that's still way high enough to incentivize trafficking networks to get rich on smuggling ivory, which then incentivizes poachers in Africa to go after the elephants themselves.
That's what you're working on trying to change?
Yeah, we have to change the demand for ivory. We have to work on attitudes in the Far East and make ivory unacceptable and immoral and unpooled. You know, it just can't be acceptable anymore. But that sort of behavior change takes a long time to percolate through a culture. If we just waited for demand reduction efforts to work, then we might not have any elephants left. But at the same time, we have to try and stem the flow of ivory out of Africa. So we have to try and make life as difficult for poachers as possible. And crucially, we need to clamp down on the trafficking networks, the ones that are really getting rich off the ivory coming out of Africa.
Are there groups like yours working on that very thing?
There's a global coalition of organizations that are working on this, and I think most of the big conservation organizations have programs. Several different programs have consolidated around these three main areas, and this is what we're all working on, is the demand reduction, anti-trafficking, and anti-poaching. And we run an elephant crisis fund to raise money to get the money out to the very best organizations that are doing the work in these specific areas. They're often ones that are just working on particular elements of the problem, and we spend a great deal of effort trying to make sure who's doing the best job. And so we do that alongside trying to come up with research-based solutions for the long term future of elephants in Africa, because we have a secondary problem to the poaching, which is Africa's human population is skyrocketing. And where there are 1.4 billion people in Africa today, by 2100, we're looking at 4 billion people in Africa. And a huge amount of agricultural development and infrastructure development is coming into Africa as well. And elephants need space. Wildlife needs space. Nature needs space. And humans are coming to take that space. And unless we plan for how we're going to share Africa's wildlife is going to get pushed out. I understand what elephants need to survive and make a plan for corridors and crossing points and hard barriers and soft barriers so that we can contain our two different species and allow them free passage as they need to and so that we can coexist.
Is this part of the new camp that you've just launched, or is that a whole separate project?
Yeah, so we've just launched a very local project in northern Kenya to try to get ahead of one of the projects that is falling under the Chinese Belt and Road Initiative, and it's called the Lamu and South Sudan Ethiopia Transport Corridor. Mm-hmm. There is a big railway and oil pipeline, highway infrastructure project with resort cities and international airports and all these things coming through, but it slices through the second largest elephant population in Kenya. The center of the elephant population is in the sort of crosshairs of this infrastructure development. And this kind of infrastructure can sever not only elephant populations, but populations of other wildlife, and you make them much more vulnerable to population decline and local extinction if you prevent them from being able to move, especially in a world where the climate is looking like it's going to change pretty rapidly. And if you animals off from where they need to move to, then you're effectively dooming them to try and survive in those conditions or perish.
How do nations like Kenya, like Botswana, feel about trying to protect their wildlife?
A lot of countries in Africa are very mindful of their elephants and their wildlife because of the tourism dollars that they represent. Where it becomes harder is we've got elephants, no tourists, and they become much harder to protect. There's a long way to go. We need to get these corridors cemented in law, but community sport has to be the first step along this journey.
Is it possible to repopulate elephants that have been lost?
Elephants are great survivors. They're smart, they're adaptable. They can live pretty much anywhere. You look at the conditions they're surviving in Mali, and they're still able to eke out a living. What they can't survive is human predation. They can live alongside humans, but they're no match for the AK-47. As long as we're not hunting them, they will survive.
That's Frank Pope, CEO of the group Save the Elephants. Well, many people enjoy playing video games, but take for granted that they can hold and easily operate game controllers. Now Microsoft is making it possible for disabled gamers to join in the fun. Tina Trin reports.
If you think video games aren't a workout, you haven't seen Andrew Pilkington play. Pilkington, who has cerebral palsy, uses his feet. And it's fitting, considering that today's game is all about football.
I think you're fine, but I kick them. field goal with my feet.
To set up his plays, Pilkington uses the Xbox Adaptive Controller by Microsoft.
The Xbox Adaptive Controller is a controller that we designed for people with limited mobility.
Designer Chris Kajowski discussed the $100 controller at the Games for Change Festival in New York.
So you can plug in any existing button or switch into any one of these.
Gamers with limited mobility typically figure out a workaround using adaptable controllers or specially designed accessories.
We wanted to make this as flexible as possible so that it let them use those products that they already have. You know, this is the same as a lot of buttons that you can buy. And we space them out on the product like this so that it's easy to rest your hand in between, rock between them.
It's the first dedicated controller from a big name. No comparable ones exist for the PlayStation or Nintendo consoles.
To see a major company take charge and really include us in gaming, it's a huge deal.
Aaron Hawley has muscular dystrophy and says gaming is a way to escape and relax.
The way that our customers were talking about gaming as a social outlet and as a human connection, it made me realize how important this product was.
You know, I've been waiting all my life for this type of technology.
It's likely Pilkington won't be the only one who scores.
What the hell? There we go.
Tina Trin, VOA News, New York.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Greg Burns. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, recently announced additional assistance to support achieving the goals outlined in the Bilateral Development Objectives Assistance Agreement between the U.S. and Nigerian governments, signed in 2015. $25 million will strengthen good governance by supporting state governments' efforts to bolster Nigeria's open government partnership commitments to improve transparency and fight corruption. An additional $1.5 million will support a healthier, more educated population in targeted states through the U.S. President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, also known as PEPFAR, for a total of $26.5 million in additional assistance. The additional new funding brings the total U.S. government assistance provided under the 5-year Development Objectives Agreement to $1.1 billion. USAID is also working with federal and state health ministries to build stronger health systems with the aim of guaranteeing equitable access to quality health care services nationwide. USAID collaborated with Nigeria's Ministries of Budget and National Planning, Health, Agriculture, Power, and Education, as well as state-level government counterparts, to structure the Bilateral Assistance Agreement, which runs through 2020. The United States believes that as the most populous country in Africa with the largest economy on the continent, Nigeria holds tremendous influence over the future of Africa, Acting Mission Director Aaron Holleran said. USAID is committed to partnering with the government and the people of Nigeria to address its development challenges.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.